All right, folks, we'll get started here. Our next speaker is Peter Kong from University of Minnesota, Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. The title of his talk is Characterization, Modeling, and Remediation of Fractured Aquifers Through Cutting-Edge Research Tools.
Hello, everyone. My name is Peter Kong, Assistant Professor at University of Minnesota. Sorry. I just arrived from California yesterday midnight, so my voice is not too good, I guess. But I'm really excited to share our group's recent work, and I think some of it should be your interest. And what I will be doing for next 30 minutes is to share our group's recent research efforts to better predict transport phenomena in fractured aquifers. As we all know, groundwater flow is essentially porous and fractured media flow. But maybe what we less appreciate is how important fractured flows are and how dominating it is in subsurface systems. So if we see near surface, it's true that it's often dominated by porous media flow, unconsolidated sediments. But as soon as you go just a little deeper, you will soon see fractured flows. And my group's research really focuses on fractures. So why I'm so passionate about fractures? There are, I think, many reasons, but to me it's so obvious that better understanding subsurface fractures are really the key to our future of energy, climate change, and water issues. So I just want to highlight two examples. For energy, as we've been discussing, mining will play an important role. Related to renewable energy, geothermal is becoming more and more hot topic, and DOE is investing a lot of funding in this technology. Related to the climate change, University of Minnesota just won major research center funded by DOE on mineral carbon mineralization, and the idea is to inject CO2 directly into deep subsurface, like mafic and ultramafic rock, and turning it into carbonate rocks in short time frame. And there are very exciting pilot studies from Oman and UK that allowed us to start a center, research center at University of Minnesota. So that won't be the topic of my talk today, but maybe in future MGWA, I would be happy to share that work. And today's talk will be focusing on groundwater. And I want to just start by stating that, as we know, the importance of groundwater as water resources is very obvious. Just by looking at the storage amount, it's more than 100 times the surface water if you think about just freshwater portion globally. Okay, so this is just showing how much of the global unfrozen freshwater is on Earth. And basically, 98% of unfrozen freshwater is in the form of groundwater. That doesn't mean we can really rely on groundwater, because we have to see the influx. And if you see, compared to surface water, what's coming into groundwater system every year is much less than surface water, meaning that once you contaminate your groundwater resources, it will take a long time to clean that out through natural recharge. And related to groundwater systems, it's very obvious that fractures are the norm rather than anomaly. So if you see near-surface aquifer systems, 75% of near-surface aquifers are considered either as fractured or karstic aquifers. And that's also the case for Minnesota. There has been a lot of progress trying to better understand groundwater flow and transport, but it's still a challenging problem. And one example that we know is happening in Minnesota, and I think this is one of the very good examples highlighting how hard it is to predict transport phenomena in groundwater systems. So what you see here, I think many of you saw this figure, but what I want to highlight is related to this example is the challenge of predicting transport phenomena. So what you see here as a color map is PFAS concentration. So the red color represent high concentration, and blue and greenish color represent lower concentration. And these are the two early identified contaminant sources. There's one more here, but let's now focus on these two contaminant sources. And before having this field data set, a groundwater consulting company tried to predict how these contaminants will spread. And basically what they predicted was under predicting how much the spreading will be, highlighting the challenge of predicting transport processes. So why was it so hard? There are many reasons, and this really allowed us to better understand how complex subsurface transport can be. And a few things are obviously heterogeneity, right? Subsurface is obviously a heterogeneous system with fractures, faults, fracture matrix interaction, and for this specific case, lake groundwater interaction was playing really a key role. So in my research, what we are trying to do is to better understand this kind of flow channeling effect due to subsurface heterogeneity and try to better predict its effect on anomalous transport. So this is a fractured sandstone image after one day of rain. And what you see here is a darker color is where the water is. So you see basically water preferentially infiltrates through fractures and then slowly diffuse into rock matrix. And this kind of flow channeling effect can really make the transport phenomena very challenging to predict. So this is just a computer simulation that shows or illustrates how heterogeneity can cause complex transport phenomena. So what you are seeing here is you can imagine injecting dye as a line injection at the inlet. And on the left is assuming homogeneous porous media, and on the right is heterogeneous system. So the darker color shows higher permeability, and bluish color shows lower permeability. And you see that there's strong flow channeling, and there's a lot of trapping. And what you see on the right is breakthrough curve, which is basically measuring arrival concentration of dye concentration at the outlet. And if you compare the two, it's obviously dramatically different, characterized by this kind of long-term retention of contaminants. So we know subsurface is heterogeneous, and we know it will cause this kind of strong tailing, and this is really important for many applications, but especially for contaminant remediation, because that will determine the timescale for remediation. And this is just an example showing natural scale modeling, which we do a lot in my research group, showing again how depending on the heterogeneity of the system, how strong the flow channeling can be. So you can think as the left side being fracture aperture being homogeneous, and on the right where the fracture aperture to be very heterogeneous, leading to this kind of strong channeling. So in my view, there are many challenges, but really what intrigues me is the two key challenges. The first is related to what I just described, related to flow channeling. And in fractured aquifers, we know that flow channeling and high flow speed can lead to very important inertia effect. So this is a down borehole video image that I got from Tony Runkel at MGS in Plotville Formation. And you see this kind of water almost jetting into air phase under natural condition, showing how dynamic groundwater flow through fractured system can be. Another video from that I got from Tony in St. Peter Sandstone, not sure whether you can see, but you see actually sediments moving through this conduit and making swirling motion because of the really fast flow speed. So you see sediments making swirling motion. And basically, we don't yet have better tools to predict contaminant transport in this type of dynamic fractured aquifers, and that's what my group is trying to contribute to. Second challenge that my group is working on is related, but more specifically, fracture matrix interaction, because in contaminant hydrology, I would say the biggest challenge is to how to remediate contaminants that got trapped in rock matrix. So what you see here is water diffusing into rock matrix, and you can imagine that contaminants going in together with water phase. And if you inject fresh water, contaminants that get trapped in matrix will still stay there and only very slowly and diffusively come back to fracture flow. So what this means is it's really challenging to remediate contaminants that's trapped in rock matrix. And my group tried to better understand how mass get transferred from fracture to matrix, matrix to fracture, and how to better remediate rock matrix. Another aspect is coupling with biogeochemistry. So now groundwater hydrologists really understand how important and how dominating biogeochemical processes can be. And these two images show geochemical reactions and biological growth causing pore scale clogging. And that kind of active biogeochemical reaction can be very vigorous at this kind of fracture matrix interface. So in the remaining time, I will be briefly going over my group's work related to addressing these challenges. So part one will be a little bit fundamental. So maybe you may think it's not related to groundwater, but actually it is. And I really want to emphasize why it is important to understand small-scale processes in order to better predict macro-scale or field-scale processes. So part one will be better understanding transport mixing and reaction at small scale. And part two will be predicting transport at network scale, combining discrete fracture network modeling with machine learning. And part three will be field application, which I'm most excited about, which I'm heavily collaborating with Minnesota Geological Survey and Bay West. And the work that I will be presenting is basically work that's produced by my research group members, so I really want to appreciate them and give them acknowledgement before I start. And I think it's only Jenna from my group who is helping a lot with dye tracing. Okay, so let's start from part one, which will be fundamental, but I think it will be a little bit give you a new perspective about groundwater flow and mixing. And it's, again, about better understanding inertia effect on mixing and reaction in fracture flows. So I just want to visually show you what I mean by inertia effect. So in fracture flows, flow can be quite fast, and one of the key signatures is this kind of recirculating flows. And this kind of recirculating flows, even though it's very small scale feature, it can have huge impact on macro scale transport because contaminants can be trapped in this recirculating area, and some contaminants will move really fast through this preferential flow channel. And it's not hard to imagine that it will also have it will also have impact on reactive transport, where you see that a mass, when it mixes with green, it turns into black, and we can clearly see how this kind of recirculating flows play a role in dominating the reaction dynamics. And what I will be sharing in this part mostly is mixing and reaction at intersection, fracture intersection. So why is it important? It's because it's really potential biogeochemical reaction hotspots. So this Nature Geoscience paper, which was published a few years ago, showed that water, oxic water coming in from near surface can mix at discrete locations with anoxic water coming in from deeper subsurface, and it can happen at multiple discrete depths. And they show that how this can basically really change the global macro scale biogeochemical processes. However, we really don't have good understanding about what's happening at intersection scale, as you can see here. So then someone might ask, why do you care? Why should we care about intersection scale? And the answer is because it governs macro scale transport phenomena. I just want to give two visual examples. So what I'm showing here is we injected contaminants at these two sources, and everything is same, and we let contaminant move from left to right. And the only difference is intersection mixing rule. So the two end member for intersection mixing rule is either no mixing, basically contaminants just follow the streamline, or everything well mixed at intersection. So you can imagine 50% going up and 50% going down. And just by changing the mixing rule and which mixing rule it follows depends on the local microscale flow field, And depending on the flow mixing rule, you show how different the spreading behavior can be. Another intriguing example is development of dissolution channels. So this you can imagine as how the car system develops. And in this recent work, we showed how the karst conduits can be really dependent on the intersection mixing rule. So what you are again seeing here, the only difference between the two simulations is the mixing rule at the intersection. And depending on the complete mixing or no mixing, you can see the global karst channel development is dramatically different. So what we've done is to better understand what controls mixing at intersections. So for this, I don't want to go into detail, but I just want to share some key technologies that we use, which is microfluidics, which allows us to visualize with laboratory experiments mixing and reaction at realistic pore and fractured media. We combine with direct numerical simulation. So what we do is basically make a microscale chip, like most simplistic case will be straight intersection. And what we use is reaction that emits light. So what it means is we inject two different fluid, A, let's say, and B. And when they mix, they emit light. So it's called chemiluminescence reaction. And it's really elegant way to quantify where the reaction is happening. So we can just passively measure the light intensity, and that gives us information about where the reaction is happening. So this is what we've got just by changing the flow rate. So our interest was how does mixing and reaction change in response to increase in flow rate. And what you see, I don't know whether it's clear enough, but actually you see complete change in where the mixing and reaction happens. So when the flow rate is slow, most of reaction only happens along the interface. But as we increase the flow rate, there is emergence of this kind of recirculating flows, which completely change the mixing dynamics. And we showed that such mixing dynamics is caused by recirculating flow, which we delineate like this. So basically, reactants can advectively enter this kind of recirculating zone. And at recirculating zone, flow is slow, and there can be a lot of mixing and reaction happening. And we can basically reproduce such observation with direct numerical simulation. And we were able to show with experiment and both simulation that such recirculating flow-induced reaction hotspots are more readily occurring in rough fracture intersections, which is more realistic case in nature. So you can again see in 3D fracture, rough fracture intersection, you see how this kind of recirculating flow develops and causing this kind of local reaction hotspots. So that's it for the first part, showing how microscale phenomena can really change what's happening at the intersection scale and how it can change global scale mixing and reactive transport. And what my group is focusing on these days is how to upscale or how to better utilize small scale understanding to have better network scale predictability. So what I will be presenting next is fracture network scale, which incorporates accurately the small scale processes and how and in thinking about how to better predict network scale transport. And for that, we combine discrete fracture network modeling with machine learning. And the first thing I want to mention is it is technically not easy, but it's definitely doable to do a intricate network scale transport modeling. But I would say the key challenge is we don't know the subsurface structure, right? If we know the structure, we can just put where the fractures are and we can predict, but we do not know. And for that, we are trying to rely on machine learning. And I want to just give you the idea how we are using machine learning for such objective. So the concept is quite simple. We can never know exactly where individual fractures are. So using machine learning, can we extract key features that is governing transport phenomena, let's say fracture density? And if we know, can we link fracture density information to what we expect to be for the transport? So in other words, We want to predict, let's say, tracer breakthrough curve, right? Arrival concentration in time. We want to know peak arrival time. We want to know slope of the decay. Can we predict directly such, let's say, late time slope from structural features like fracture density and connectivity? And for that, we have to rely on machine learning. And I think we started to have really exciting results showing that it is somewhat, it seems to be possible. So let me show you an example. So what we do is we generate thousands of fracture networks, and then we run flow and transport simulation, and then we measure arrival concentration at the outlet. And what this means is, let me go back here, from the thousands of simulation, you can get 1,000 information about each realization's fracture structure properties, and you have the response. And using machine learning, you can train your model, and you can try to predict directly from the structural information to fracture tailing. So one context that I want to give you is that dead end fractures has been considered as the origin of such tailing of breakthrough curve, because as you can see here, tracers can enter this kind of dead end fracture, but the flow in this kind of dead end fracture is very slow, so that it can basically play a role as a trapping effect. But there, it was mostly speculation, and scientists discussed that it's likely that this kind of dead end fractures are the cause for tailing or late time arrival, but it has been never quantitatively really proven. And I believe what I'm showing, what I will be showing you with machine learning is first data-driven proof that dead-end fractures are indeed causing late-time tailing. So again, we generate thousands of realizations that follows different fracture statistics. For each realization, we can do graph representation, and then we can, for example, quantify percentage of dead-end fractures. So here the red fractures are dead-end fractures, and through the graph representation, we can accurately identify exactly where the dead-end fractures are. And then we use machine learning. So from the graph representation, we can get fracture density, we can get connectivity, percentage of dead-end fractures, a lot of key information. And then we train machine learning and see whether we can find the importance of each network features, and can we predict transport directly from structural properties. So this is the result. So basically, the plot showing is the importance of each feature in predicting late time tailing or the decay rate of your breakthrough curve. And I was very excited to see this result, because what you see here is the feature that's ranked first with thousands of high resolution simulation was indeed dead end fracture. Meaning that it's really with a lot of data, we were able to show that dead-end fracture is a key cause for late-time tailing. And we were able to show that using machine learning, so this, I don't think we have to spend too much time, but basically this is showing that dead-end fracture trend can predict the tailing trend. And we can use machine learning, and with less than second, basically we can predict tailing decay rate using structural information. So this brings to our last part. So in the next 5 minutes, I want to talk about how we are trying to bring this improved fundamental understanding into real world. And for this, I have to say I've been so fortunate to work with people like Scott Alexander, Kelvin Alexander, Tony Runkel, and many people from Minnesota Geological Survey, and also with Bay West. So we have a fractured aquifer site actually on campus. So it's fortunate and unfortunate that part of the University of Minnesota campus is actually built upon the contaminated fractured aquifer site. Good for my research, but I guess bad for the university. So literally our office, which you see with this red circle, is 15-minute walking distance from the contaminated fractured limestone site. And here, thanks to Tony and Bob Tipping, we really have good understanding about geology, specifically related to fractures. It's an amazing site, I have to say. I really believe that this site will become one of the world famous sites, and that's what my group and Tony are collaborating on. And the reason it's so special is we have not only outcrop information from the river bluff, but the contamination, as many of you know, is discovered through underground library construction. And we have the information of fracture outcrop also deep inside. So, and we can delineate fractures or just basically by looking at the ceiling. Tony and Bob and Minnesota Geological Survey spent a lot of effort to come up with 3D conceptual model representing plot bill formation. And then now we are, my group is trying to use such understanding to predict transport phenomena. The site has horizontal well, which is continuously operating and causing this kind of groundwater level elevation. And it's actually, again, amazingly good for modeling purpose because this horizontal well is more or less causing this kind of uniform head drop from far away from the horizontal well towards horizontal well, making the modeling somewhat simpler. So we conducted a dye tracing experiment. We did get a variance approval from MDH. And we've done, we injected tracer from this injection well, and we measured arrival concentration at this pumping well. And we got this beautiful breakthrough curve showing very persistent power law decay with slope 1, which is actually very, very slow decay. Someone like me, when I first see this kind of tracer breakthrough curve, first thing I would ask is, how is it possible to have such a slow decay? And this means it's quite bad for contaminant remediation because it will take really long time. So for example, a slope smaller than 2 is considered small, and slope closer to 1 is considered really, really slow decay. And the hypothesis that we had was there is an active interaction between fracture flow and nearby rock matrix. This is an ongoing research, so what I'm sharing you now is literally the result that we got a few weeks ago, so there are a lot of room to improve, but I think we have some exciting results to share. So the reason we came up with this hypothesis is related to, again, our small-scale study. So this is single fracture with rock matrix, and what we conducted is we injected tracer at the inlet and measured arrival concentration giving tracer breakthrough curve. And what we changed in this different simulation is the matrix permeability. So just by changing how permeable surrounding matrix is, that determines how contaminants diffuse into rock matrix. And we showed that increase in fluid fracture matrix exchange leads to the slope closer to 1. So that's what we try to do. So we have detailed site information. We constructed 3D discrete fracture network with fracture matrix interaction. And this is a site-based numerical simulation result. And we can measure arrival concentration. This is the modeling result. So blue is the field data, and the black is our simulation. And as you can see, the modeling prediction improves from left to right. And basically what we change here is the matrix permeability and solute dispersivity, somewhat supporting our hypothesis that increase in fracture matrix interaction may be the cause for such a slow decay. Again, it requires a lot of site information to confirm this hypothesis. We will be doing detailed core scale analysis to test how better prove our hypothesis, and more exciting work is really ongoing with in collaboration with MGS and Bay West. In last 1 to 2 minutes, I want to share our work about how to remediate then such contaminants that gets trapped in rock matrix. So as I explained, the biggest challenge in fractured contaminant hydrogeology is how to remove contaminants that get trapped in rock matrix. And the work that we are doing, partly in collaboration with Professor Carl Santelli at U of M, who will be presenting this afternoon, I believe, we are looking at the possibility of using fungi isolated from the site for the rock matrix remediation. So Dr. Sang Lee, postdoc in my group, basically used successfully isolated fungi from the site. And what's really amazing about the fungi is it can generate enormous amount of pressure And there are reports showing that fracture hypergrowth can actually fracture rock, meaning that it may be able to access rock matrix in a very active way. So using the isolated fungi, we've conducted visual experiments to demonstrate our idea. It's not about fracturing the rock, but because the pore space is in the order of several microns and fungi hyper length scale is less than that, we wanted to test if fungi can actively enter into rock matrix. So this is the experimental result where we have the oil phase trapped in this rock matrix, and now we are slowly injecting water with fungi in it, and you see fungi, as fungi grows, it causes the clogging, and actually, but it's good for accessing rock matrix because, as you can see here, water gets diverted into matrix because of the reduction in permeability in rock matrix, and you see similar phenomena in a close view. What's happening when the injection rate is slow is even more exciting. So this, what I'm showing is after injecting fungi for a while, we stop the flow and just let fungi play their role. And what you are seeing here is, I believe, first direct visual demonstration of fungi actively growing into rock matrix and then displacing oil phase, which I believe have huge potential for many applications. So with that, I'd like to conclude. I think the take-home message from my talk is that microscale phenomena is important. It's not just for the satisfaction of academics. It really affects macroscale transport phenomena. And by combining machine learning with fracture natural scale modeling, we are getting some exciting research showing that maybe we will be able to use just natural characteristics like dead end fracture portion or fracture density, we will may be able to directly predict transport. And there is really strong need for better understanding biogeochemical processes in groundwater systems and field-based demonstration. With that, I'd like to acknowledge my funding agencies, and we'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
I worked with a guy in Canada. He was looking at injecting surfactants into the groundwater to mobilize fraction portions of, you know, petroleum, and it created hydrophobic molecule structures or colloids or whatever. It reduced the permeability of the water. Have you looked at that at your micro bench scale testing, how that affects all your models? Sounds like you did permeability on one of them.
I'm aware of those kinds of work, basically changing the wettability so that water can better replace oil. We didn't directly play with surfactant, but what I can tell you is what I showed you, fungi has similar effect. So what you see here, I don't know whether you can see, but you can actually see individual hypae. Maybe you cannot see, but you see the water phase going in, and it's almost synchronized with fungi entering into oil phase. And that, the reason for that is fungi is hydrophilic, and that allows water to enter into oil phase.
So is the fungi able to attack like the bound oil that's bound to the mineral by the wettability?
You said boundary?
No, is like the oil that's bound to the minerals, is it able to kind of access that in the really tight pore throats?
Like oil film that is on the mineral surface?
Yeah, based on the wettability of the mineral, if the oil is like
bound. I think it's too soon to conclude on that. What's for sure is, again, I showed that if there's oil phase trapped between pore space, fungi can access, but whether how much fungi can directly consume and remove oil films along the mineral surfaces is, I think, we didn't address that question yet. We did run batch experiments, and we show that there is actual direct consumption happening, but at how much intensity, it's ongoing open question.
And then also, I guess it would be really cool or is anybody looking at visualizing this stuff with like tomography or anything? Can you see in an actual 3D sample where the fungi goes?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea. And in my research community, micro-CT is becoming an active tool. So one can imagine injecting fungi into actual rock core and scan it. And there are research groups that can visualize biofilm using micro-CT scanning. So in theory, I think it's possible to see where the fungi went in 3D rock core. I guess, but it has cannot be real time because the X-ray scanning can be detrimental to the process. Yeah.
Hi, my question is more time dependent. This site was because of PAH contamination from a coal gasification plant, and set up over decades, and the fungus was self-selected. There's food and it's going to grow, and then the university comes in and disturbs that system by putting in the caverns.
We didn't yet put.
And then of course that caused all kinds of problems.
Or good things.
And it's great to turn the problem into a benefit to get research. Done, but my question is, okay, then they put in the horizontal well to intercept the contaminants, and then you did a dye trace, and you get a tail,
mm-hmm.
a characteristic
mm-hmm.
slope.
Mm-hmm.
My question is it, that fungus is still active in that system, and as the horizontal well has changed the system, would you expect to see a different tail as the biofilm grows?
Mm-hmm.
And are there any, short question is, are there any plans to repeat your tracer test?
So
whether or not the biofilm is actually affecting the system.
Yeah, but I think thank you for the very important question. So first, I do expect there will be change in decay if fungi really actively grows enough, and there are laboratory studies showing that in growth in biofilm, completely changing the tailing slope. So it's definitely possible, but the question is at how much spatial scale that fungi can really actively grow. And we didn't, of course, apply this yet to the site, and I don't know whether we can be able to do it, but this is just showing some possibilities. And of course, there can be many negative side effects, which has to be looked into, and that's part of research. Yeah, I'm not yet proposing to do this at the MLAC site. I'm just sharing some early laboratory results.
Oh no, I think it's great. It was just that to me, it's all about what's happening out there in the world,
mm-hmm.
and so to me, it would be a good question to ask whether or not the fungus is actually changing the system,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because we've intercepted the water. The water's flowing differently,
mm-hmm.
and therefore it might actually change the system.
Yeah, I think inevitably as fungi grows, maybe the contaminant level will locally increase because there's change in flow structure, as you mentioned. But it depends on what you want. If the landowner wants to really actively remediate site, I think it makes sense to do that kind of active remediation. Or if you want to have more natural attenuation, then I guess you will just do the monitoring of the state.
Just very quickly, the second part of Justin's question was whether you plan on doing additional dye traces.
Oh,
which you do, I assume.
Yes. That's,
there's a number of other wells to choose from also.
Yes. Yeah. We definitely plan to do that. And I've been actively integrating it into our earth science courses, which is benefiting a lot our undergrads. So I think that will be the ongoing plan to be done at the site.
My question relates to sort of mining environments and some of the applications for this work, which is fascinating, by the way. I was specifically wondering about, the karst topography and the limestone gives you a really, advantage with respect to, you know, timing of this stuff, but I'm wondering about more like crystalline, massive, you know, basement rock, fracture networks. Is there some parallel application there? And my second question is, and I'm really just fascinated with the fungi application here, but one of the things we struggle with in mining is infiltration into like waste rock dumps. So extremely fractured rock masses. I'm wondering if there's any application there with respect to sort of mitigating or preventing or decreasing sort of net percolation into those systems.
Is your first question about the predicting transport or related to fungi?
The first one's just related to predicting transport, yeah.
Yeah, definitely what we've done is applicable to there, and the matrix flow effect will be less important, and there are a lot of advancement related to nuclear waste disposal. And basically, I'm in a similar community in terms of my academic research. So yeah, there has been a lot of advancement. And with what I've showed, I think we have good chance to advance in terms of better predicting and also in crystalline rocks. Though I think it will be more challenging than what I've showed at Platteville, because based on MGS work, we had very good geological understanding, but I think that's more challenging in crystalline rocks. Related to second question, I'd be happy to discuss, but I think I need to better understand your the setup that you're describing. But yeah, I think there's great potential for application. Yeah.